I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When the pilgrims landed, they were greeted by an English-speaking Indian asking for beer. Who got to America before the Mayflower? That's coming up. But first, tomorrow in Baghdad, leaders from Iraq's feuding factions will announce an agreement designed to heal ethnic and sectarian strife. The Boston Globe reports that the deal, first hammered out during meetings in Helsinki, Finland, was forged by key members from both Shiite and Sunni parties. The pact is not expected to have an immediate effect on the ground, and there are skeptics. But to supporters, the private effort at diplomacy is a miracle. Joining us from Baghdad is Padraig O'Malley, the University of Massachusetts at Boston professor and longtime peacemaker who convened these talks. He's had successful reconciliation efforts in Northern Ireland and South Africa. He brought former enemies from both those countries to the table for talks in Helsinki and more recently Iraq. Padraig, the previous talks between these Iraq leaders had been very secretive. They were flown to Helsinki. Tomorrow's announcement of this pact will be public in the Al Rashid Hotel in the Green Zone in Baghdad. How significant is that for you?
It shows that not just the Shia and the Sunni parties, but also the Kurds, who were an integral part of the second round of talks at Helsinki, are in agreement as to the framework of rules and behavior that should determine the way in which they negotiate in the future. Every party in Iraq put their names to it.
Not Prime Minister Maliki, but his key aide, not Ahmadi Army leader Muqtada al-Sadr, but two key aides of his, minority Sunni leaders as well.
Sunni blocs, the Sadrist blocs, the Fadila blocs, the Kurdistan blocs, every single bloc.
Well, Padraig, what are the specifics of the agreement?
The commitment to the use of peaceful and democratic means to resolve political disputes and banning the use of arms by armed groups during negotiations, renouncing all forms of terrorism, opposing international and regional interfering in Iraq's affairs, commitment to the principle of the independence of the judiciary and respecting its rulings and decisions, building the Iraqi armed forces and the security forces and their requirements on a professional basis with the aim of ending the presence of foreign troops in the country.
Well, let's take this one at a time. It's interesting that the followers of Muqtada al-Sadr agreed to a ban on illegal militias, but does that mean that Sadr's Mahdi army is going to disband?
No. I think a document like this lays the framework for further discussions on what is an armed militia and what is not an armed militia. It represents the first move in the direction of the Sadrists being willing to consider not using armed force to pursue their political goals.
The pact also calls for forming an independent advisory committee to provide practical solutions aimed at remedying the negative effects of the past. Is that a call for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, much like South Africa has? And how would that be handled since the Shia, who are now the majority, see themselves as so oppressed by the Sunnis in the past, but the Sunnis, who are now in the minority, are still humiliated by the overthrow of Saddam Hussein? So who would be the aggrieved party if there were a Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
My sense would be that this is far too early to talk about a Truth and Reconciliation Commission along the lines of South Africa, that the country is not yet ready for it. But what it does embody the principle that at some point, Iraq will have to deal with the legacy of the past.
I suppose the same would be said of the very contentious issue of distribution of oil, so we'll put that aside, but ask, Padraig O'Malley, what did you say to these Iraqi leaders, and what did the former enemies from South Africa and Northern Ireland say to get to this point? Can you put your finger on the one thing that helped?
Yes. The key thing was that in the end, one, you must talk with your enemy, no matter how you despise him, no matter how he has humiliated him. Two, that you must compromise, that there is no such word in the dictionary of negotiations as never, because you find yourself in the end always compromising on issues that for years you said you would never compromise on.
Padraig O'Malley, a veteran peacemaker, professor at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. By the way, the talks that he forged were funded by a Massachusetts furniture maker and former student of yours, Padraig, I believe, Robert Benetton.
Yes.
Yeah.
Robert Benetton, who is a trustee of Tufts University, and Tufts University was one of the conveners of the talks in Helsinki, and a magnificent partner.
Well, Iraq leaders are expected to announce their pact tomorrow in Baghdad. Padraig, best of luck to you with it.
Thank you ever so much, and happy Independence Day.
Thank you. Well, on this 4th of July, as we celebrate the country's birth, we know that Columbus discovered America, well, the outer Bahamas, in 1492. The Pilgrims landed in Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1620. But what happened in between, and actually long before? Tony Horowitz asked those questions and found that Vikings huddled in peat moss hobbit homes when they weren't fighting the natives they called Skraelings. Spanish conquistadors read a document, sort of an early Miranda rights, to Southwest natives just before slaughtering them. Another Spanish commander slaughtered French Protestants, but spared those who converted to Catholicism and a few musicians to play for dancing. Just a few details in Tony's new book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. It's what happened in the 128 years between Columbus and the Pilgrims. Tony, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You start the book here at Plymouth Rock, where we are here in Boston, Massachusetts, outside Boston, where a guide tells you that visitors actually think that Plymouth Rock is where Columbus dropped off the Pilgrims.
Yeah, people are bewildered by the 1620 that's etched on the rock. They say, why doesn't it say 1492? Isn't that when Columbus came? And many visitors think Columbus sailed here, dropped off the Pilgrims, and sailed home.
Yes, on the Mayflower, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria.
Exactly.
All at once. They're
yeah.
all in an armada. Well, that's just one of the details in your book. We also learn that Verrazzano had the first encounter with Native Americans 100 years before the Pilgrims did, when he went to the Carolinas. And then when he sailed north, Native Americans mooned him. He called their territory the land of bad people. He later changed it to Maine. As you're learning this history yourself, you are thinking what?
Well, it's just strange the way we remember our history. It's almost as if we remember it in units from school, a unit on Columbus in 1492, and then we sort of leap ahead to the Pilgrims, and then
founding
fathers.
Right.
And these huge periods in between just end up being really blank. And certainly for me, that 1492 to 1620 period, I really knew almost nothing about what happened here at that time, and I think most Americans don't.
Well, for instance, that's why some are surprised to hear that when the Pilgrims landed, they were greeted by an Indian named Samoset, who spoke to them in English and asked for a beer, because others had come before. Now, tick us through.
Well, I begin the book with the Vikings, because while they never came to what's now the U.S., they did reach North America, what's now Newfoundland, 1,000 years ago. But the Spanish are really the first, beginning with Juan Ponce de Leon, and a series of conquistadors really rampage across half of the U.S. And at roughly the same time, you also have French, Italians not named Columbus, and others who are roaming not just the fringes, but all the way to central Kansas.
Well, let's go back to the Vikings just for a second, although some would say that's cheating. I mean, Newfoundland, really. I mean, that's not mainland USA, but still, 1,000 years before the Pilgrims, we learn that the first European American continental birth might have been a Viking boy named Snorri.
Exactly. If Americans know that at all, they think of Virginia Dare, who's an English girl who's born in North Carolina in 1587. Well, turns out there was this Viking boy named Snorri who's born about 1,000 years ago, so almost 600 years before Virginia Dare.
Relatives of Leif Erikson were part of this exploring, and this was a settlement that failed. Mm-hmm. Is that the story of the early explorers? They failed, obviously.
Yeah, the failure rate is huge. Really, it's a story of mistakes. The the Vikings really stumble on the coast of America. Columbus thinks he's headed to Asia. Almost none of these explorers really find what they think they're going to find, but in the process of pursuing their myths and mistakes, they uncover huge parts of this world that was unknown to Europeans.
Well, let's talk about the Spanish conquistadors. You have De Coronado and others in the West. It was the first time natives and Caucasians saw each other, mm-hmm. and it was jarring.
Right. Really, what you have over and over again in this period is this experience we simply can't have today, first contact. Think about seeing a horse or a pig for the first time, as the natives did when the Spanish arrived. The Europeans, contrary to what we might think, tend to be shorter, smaller, less impressive physically than the Indians. So they're often kind of quite awed by these natives.
Some survived. You went to find the Zuni people? Mm-hmm. Tell us about them.
Yeah, the Zuni are remarkable to me because they're really hit by the very first wave of Spanish conquest in the Southwest. Coronado arrives in 1540, defeats them in battle. Yet they survive to this day on their own land, speaking their own language, practicing their traditional religion. And also they're descendants of Spanish families that settled there soon after in New Mexico. And needless to say, they remember this history very differently and really still argue over it and even desecrate each other's monuments. So it's a little bit like Civil War memory in the South. It's something that's very real for people today.
Well, let's switch to Florida, where you also found communities in St. Augustine who debate what happened there, the slaughter of the Huguenots by the Spanish.
When the Europeans weren't killing natives, they were often killing each other. The wars of religion in Europe spilled over to America. And when the French Huguenots or Protestants established a colony in Florida in the 1560s, the Spanish came and chased them out and massacred hundreds of them in this act really of religious violence. And again, still to this day, Protestants and Catholics in that part of Florida have sort of parallel ceremonies, either honoring what they view as the Protestant martyrs or as the Spanish Catholic conquerors.
You visited a Protestant church where the children reenact the slaughter of the Huguenots.
Right.
But you also met a man in Florida who made national news, by the way. He's the one who said St. Augustine had the first Thanksgiving, you know, long before the pilgrims did. And he defended Menendez and the Spanish in slaughtering the French. He said, well, he could hardly feed his own colony. How could he also have these French there?
Right.
So this is still going on. This is very living history for people.
It is, and often remembered in ways that are surprising. I mean, the ones who have embraced the French Protestants, for instance, are actually evangelicals, not of French descent, but they have started dragging crosses onto the park where that commemorates the site of the French fort and have really embraced these people from almost 500 years ago as sort of seminal Protestant martyrs on this continent. So it's always surprising to see how people remember this history.
Tony Horowitz's new book is A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. Another place in America where early explorers are still contested, it's the site of the Spanish conqueror Juan de Onate's statue in El Paso, Texas. It congratulates him as an early discoverer, but Native Indians in that area remember him every year as the conqueror who decimated indigenous people, cutting off their feet as punishment. They wanted to erect a statue of a foot. We'll have more with Tony in 1 minute, Here and Now, and later, Jesse Helms' legacy. Back in a minute, Here and Now. On this July 4th, author Tony Horowitz is telling us about what happened in the 128 years between Columbus and the landing of the Pilgrims. He found that even things people think they know, they don't. Pocahontas and John Smith in Jamestown, for example, she was just 10 when they met. There's no evidence of a romantic relationship. In fact, she married another settler, John Rolfe. They went to England together, and she died tragically young. And the story John Smith told about Pocahontas rescuing him, he may have lifted that from the documented story of Juan Ortiz, a Spanish castaway who was rescued by a native princess and wrote about it decades before Jamestown. Some of the other explorers we've now forgotten include Cabeza de Vaca, who started out as a typical Spanish conquistador. Tony, he was shipwrecked, naked, hungry. Indians took him in. He writes, they sat down with us. They felt such great pain and pity, they began to cry.
One of the most astonishing stories to me from this period is that of a man named Cabeza de Vaca, who's a Spaniard on a conquistador expedition to Florida that goes terribly wrong from the start. And he ends up being a castaway, taken in by coastal natives. and begins with three other men wandering the interior, being passed from tribe to tribe as celebrated medicine men. And over the course of 8 years, these men make it all the way from Florida to the Gulf of California before going into Mexico and returning to Spanish territory. Cabeza de Vaca writes a very riveting account of this ordeal, which to me is one of the great survival and adventure stories of all times.
And what year was this?
This was between 1528 and 1536. He and three other men, one of them a black slave named Estevanico, crossed the entire continent more than 260 years before Lewis and Clark. Yet I think it's fair to say that most Americans have never even heard of Cabeza de Vaca or of his companions.
Another Spanish explorer, Hernando de Soto, pillaged through the South. In what's now Tennessee, he and his men stayed with Indians, enjoying their hospitality. But you write, when the chief refused de Soto's request for 30 women, de Soto burned his fields, made 500 tribesmen his baggage carriers. Then there were the Mound people. These are thriving indigenous cities of mounds half a mile long. The people ultimately disappeared. Some mounds remain. You write Americans like Thomas Jefferson became fascinated with figuring out who built the mounds. They didn't think Indians could. Of course they did.
Yeah, it's not only the European history that's lost from this era. It's the native history. And one of the most astonishing aspects of that is what's known as the mound culture in the South and Mississippi Valley, where you had enormous, very settled, very sophisticated civilizations that existed right into the 1500s when the Spanish encountered them. And the remnants of those mounds still exist in Georgia and Alabama and other states. But again, it's this history that strangely we've almost forgotten.
Well, and forgotten also is that one of these cultures was ruled by a woman. Mm-hmm. And De Soto and his men carted the queen off.
Yeah, Hernando De Soto kidnapped. She's known as the Lady of Cofetachequi in what's now South Carolina, ruled this vast empire. And he carts her off as he marches west across the Appalachians. But she does manage to escape and flee home. So it's one of the few sort of happy endings in this chapter of De Soto, who's really a butcher.
And who dies a broken man. On the banks of the Mississippi.
Right.
There were other Spanish explorers who didn't see their role as just burning down Indian villages. Mm-hmm. For instance, one, when he came across Native Americans, told his men to sit down.
You know, I think we too often see the Spanish only in stereotype and sort of imagine they were all butchers. In fact, there were men of conscience who really did believe in treating the natives well. And there's one, Hernando de Alarcón, who goes up the Colorado River. And it's just obviously a very sensitive man. And yes, when he encounters Native Americans, orders his men to sit down and put their weapons down, and manages really through nonverbal contact to travel peacefully for hundreds of miles and have, again, this extraordinary experience of first contact, great detail about how they kind of communicated through hand signs and even crude sculptures, little stick sculptures. And he got quite a ways and back with no violence at all.
Some of the most stunning passages are about sheer discovery. You know, the Spanish explorers who are looking over into the Grand Canyon and trying to describe that, or going across the Great Plains and just like, well, there's a lot of grass here, you know. Just they couldn't even grasp it. It was that different a land.
Yeah. I think reading these accounts from this period really restores your sense of wonder at this continent. We're quite blasé about it. We live here. We've seen much of it. But when the Spaniards, for instance, first reached the plains, they've never seen anything like this. They ride for weeks and weeks and weeks across flat grassland with nothing but huge herds of buffalo, and they're just astonished by it, as are the Plains Indians by them. They'd never seen horses before, and suddenly these armored men arrive, you know, out of nowhere.
Perhaps attached to the horses.
Yeah, exactly. They seemed almost to be one, man and beast.
Columbus, again, has more things named after him in the U.S. than any of these explorers that, you know, we've been talking about, who actually were on mainland America. You say he was sort of trapped in his own vision of what he wanted to find instead of having a blank slate of what might be. Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
I certainly was taught that Columbus was sort of one of the first great moderns, a modern thinker who saw the world as it is and went out there and sort of defied the medieval myths about the world and made this great discovery. He was actually the opposite. He was more of a medieval mystic himself. He touches down at shores all across Latin America, Central, South America, the Caribbean, but the more he sees, the less he learns. He keeps thinking he's at the edge of Asia or he's near King Solomon's Mines. He gets kind of more mystic the further he goes along and really goes to his deathbed, one in disgrace, but also convinced that he's reached Asia.
So, Tony Hurwitz, your journey, retracing the steps and the history of America's early explorers, has resulted in the book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. Today on the 4th of July, as we set off fireworks, we're celebrating conquistadors and the French Huguenots and some insane people in some cases, Native Americans. I mean, as somebody said, the country's roots are far more twisted than we know.
They're twisted and they go deeper. Particularly, I think, on July 4th, we're sort of reminded that we're a young country, the New World, but in fact, we're a lot older than we think. Speaking only of the European history here, it goes back 1,000 years in North America and a good 500 years here in what's now the U.S., and I think it's important to remember all those tangled roots, as you called them.
Tony, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, later today, the sizzling sounds of summer insects after the news, here and now. This 4th of July weekend, most Americans or more Americans are staying put. AAA reports that about 500,000 fewer people are traveling this weekend due to higher gasoline and airfares. But at the same time, there are other travelers who are paying premiums of $5,000 to $10,000 for once-in-a-lifetime experiences, like getting a private viewing of the Sistine Chapel or taking weaving lessons from Mayan villagers. It's called authentic travel, and the U.S. Tour Operators Association says 80% of travel agencies have seen an increase in these types of tours since 2006. For more on this, we turn first to Zach Rabinor of Journey Mexico. He sets up authentic tours throughout Mexico. Zach, tell us, when you say authentic, what do you mean?
Well, our mission is to really provide travelers with authentic interaction, real interaction, unstaged interaction with the people, the places, the cultures, the communities of Mexico, and allow them to experience it without any parrots on the shoulder, but as it really is.
I'm reading in Forbes magazine about a trip you take, a 9-day hike you take people on in Copper Canyon in Mexico. Why? What do they see there?
Well, the geography is spectacular. The Copper Canyon is four times the volume of the Grand Canyon, so the vistas and the canyon bottom towns are very impressive. The local communities and indigenous native peoples there are very much still living traditional lifestyles. They live in their homes that are perched on the canyon walls. And so it's much like what it must have been like to visit the Grand Canyon about 100 years ago when the Hopi Pueblos were living at the canyon bottom.
I wonder, how much do these trips cost?
It varies depending on the group size between $2,000 and $2,200 per person. And there's a maximum group size of 12 people, speaking to the importance of low impact and group size in facilitating more authentic interaction.
That's not a lot. That doesn't include airfare, I'm guessing.
No, that's only ground, but it does include all lodging, most meals.
But here's the question. If, in fact, you've been taking trips through and they have encounters with the indigenous peoples who live there, don't you then change the tarahumara, and so they aren't really the authentic people that they might have been before you came through?
That's a good point. All interaction has a footprint, but we don't look to always cut a new swath because we look to concentrate our impact in places where the relationships that we have and the people we meet are more our friends, and thus the interaction can be more legitimate and more authentic than always coming into new places, surprising people, and having that awkwardness that a true first encounter would have.
What do you say to people who say there's something uncomfortable about this? There's a gawking nature, people going and staring at people, and that it's somewhat demeaning, it somewhat objectifies them.
When we do come in contact with some of the communities where, they stand off and they're shy, we don't encourage to go and invade their space or to force a situation.
It's tricky because, one way not to demean someone, it would be to pay them so that they're a participant with you. Do you pay the tarahumara?
Well, what we do on a particular trip is we actually set up our camps on the edge of certain homesteads. And there we do pay a fee, a usage fee for the area, and also we're using their water sources and so on. But paying people that we come across on the trail, if there's no legitimate interaction or trade of services or goods, we see that as a more negative impact unless there's some interchange, whether it be the purchase of some kind of crafts or the trade of some kind of good or water or food. It seems that that would be degrading in itself to give someone money out of pity or,
right,
or sympathy.
Because if you pay an indigenous person, then they may stand there for a photograph they really don't want to take, but they need the money. That's Zach Rabinor of Journey Mexico speaking to us from Mexico, where he sets up authentic tours for travelers. Zach, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Well, and we learned about Zach through the writing of Rebecca Ruiz. She wrote about authentic vacations for Forbes.com. Rebecca, what are some of the other tours that, you know, you learned about in your research?
Well, there are some very interesting tours. There's a culinary tour in Vietnam where you can go and meet chefs in local restaurants and even go to the countryside and meet a woman who makes 1,200 pieces of rice paper a day. You can go to Italy where you'll be introduced to a violin maker whose family has been in the business for generations. You can go to Japan and learn about how to become a geisha. You can go to a tea plantation in India and learn from workers there what it's like.
Distinguish this from traveling that's been going on for a few decades. The station that we're at here in Boston, WBUR, used to have something called Citizens of the World Tours, very small groups that went and traveled, you know, educational purposes. Quo Vadis, a company here in Boston, made inroads into places that hadn't been traveled in before. One of the first companies to go to Libya, for instance. So this has been going on for a while. What's so different about this authentic travel?
It has been going on for a while, and I think what is different about it is that it's gotten much more sophisticated, and that travel companies and travel agents are working with people like Zach in the destination country to arrange these very personalized tours, and they rely largely on sort of locals who know, you know, the ins and outs of the places that you're going to go, and they'll set up meetings with everyone from government officials to monks in temples to farmers, and the experiences are becoming much more personalized.
Well, you profile a woman who really did get a private tour of a closed Sistine Chapel?
She did. She spent the first hour in the Sistine Chapel before it opened to the public with three other friends.
Well, what do you think about some of the ethical questions that are raised? You write about a tour company that takes people into the slums of Mumbai in India and Bombay, and that's where some critics have said, well, look, first of all, there are poor people right in your backyard, undoubtedly, and it sort of romanticizes poverty.
When you bring people into the slum and there's no interaction between there, and in fact, the person who organized that tour told me he felt that was the weakness of the tour, that there was little interaction between the tourists who went there and the people who lived in the slum. He's trying to fix that, but without some kind of exchange, it does give it the feeling of voyeurism.
Well, as you write, of going to the zoo.
Right.
Well, that's the downside, but, you know, give us an example of something that, you know, marvelous that might be happening for someone because of this new thinking about travel.
So the marvelous examples for people generally include just having their eyes open to another culture or another way of life. And again, when I talk to people who've done trips like these, that's what they say. You know, they went to Africa, they went to India, they went to China, they went to Guatemala, and they learned about a way of life they didn't know about yet. And specifically, I spoke with a woman who's done several of these trips, and one of them was to Syria. And she was walking down the street, and she saw a man who was making bread, and she thought to herself, wow, this is really authentic. And they made eye contact, and he came over, and he offered her a piece of bread. And that may seem like a small incident or small experience, but to her it was very powerful, and she remembered it just because to her it felt like you can be halfway across the world and still connect with other people.
That's Rebecca Ruiz. She wrote about authentic vacations for Forbes.com. Rebecca, where are you going this summer?
I'm going to California, actually, to visit family, but also to do a little bit of camping along the beach. I went to Ireland earlier this year, and I think that's probably a country people think a lot about authenticity.
Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, happy trails to you. Next week on Here and Now, after the dust settles and outside of his POW experience, what was John McCain's military career? That's next week. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. One of the most polarizing figures in American politics died today. Former Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina was 86. He was known as Senator No for opposing just about anything that obstructed his conservative view of the world and derided by Democrats for his opposition to civil rights. But his supporters applauded his stand against civil rights, gay rights, and what he perceived as obscene art. Today, the head of the Conservative Heritage Foundation said that along with Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, Helms helped establish the conservative movement and became a powerful voice for free markets and free people. Helms served 5 terms in the Senate. He retired in 2002 because of health problems. Elizabeth Dole now serves in his seat. Joining us is Earl Black, co-author of Divided America, The Ferocious Power Struggle in American Politics. He's in Houston, Texas. And Earl, how would you say Jesse Helms will be remembered?
Well, Jesse Helms was a key example of the transition from the old segregationist Southern Democrats who had dominated the old Southern politics. He was born and bred as a Democrat in the segregated South of the 40s and 50s and early 60s. And he brought that tradition that before had been associated with the Southern Democrats who had filibustered the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the Senate. He brought that into the Republican Party was an example of the early primitive strain of Southern Republicanism, relied very, very greatly on conservative views on race, especially for his early victories. And whenever he was in need of something in a close campaign, he could be relied upon to go back. So I think in a lot of ways, that tradition of segregationist Republicanism was very much of an embarrassment to a lot of the Republicans. It's now passé, thankfully, in both political parties in the South. But he was the embodiment of that transition mm-hmm. that brought the South from the most democratic part of the country into one that the Republicans now rely upon pretty heavily.
You mentioned his opposition to civil rights issues. In particular, he opposed creating a holiday honoring Martin Luther King Jr. And his critics called him a racist, but in his 2005 memoir, he said he wasn't the least bit racist.
Well, that's Senator Helms, I think, in retrospect. Actually, I think he was a classic example of the born and bred Southern Democratic segregationist who became a Southern Republican segregationist. And that was the way in which he extended his success in North Carolina, extended his appeal to less educated, more blue-collar, rural, small-town whites. Country Club in North Carolina, they never really warmed up to Senator Helms. He wasn't their kind of Republican, but he was able to come into the Senate on the Nixon landslide in 1972 in North Carolina. And then he was always reelected, never defeated, but he never won reelection by huge amounts because he did it the hard way. His views were so militant on anything that touched on race that he could never win by big margins. The contrast would be with South Carolina's Strom Thurmond, who was the earliest Southern Democrat to become a Republican. Thurmond, once he became a Republican senator, reached out to a lot of blacks in small towns, particularly black mayors, helped them with their projects, and was able to extend his coalition. So he really didn't have the kind of close battles that Jesse Helms did. Thurmond did it the easy way. Helms was much more militant. He did it the hard way, and he survived, but really not by very much.
How do you think Jesse Helms would have felt about dying on the 4th of July? Other famous Americans have, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe.
Well, I'm sure if he were in a position to understand it, he would take some real pleasure in that. He was small town North Carolina, shifted to the big city, growing big city, the state capital of Raleigh, as the basis for his later political career. But he would have appreciated the fact that he had done something that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams did as well.
Earl Black, co-author of Divided America, The Ferocious Power Struggle in American Politics. Earl, thanks for joining us on short notice, the notice that Jesse Helms at 86 has died. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rod.
Okay, we'll be back in 1 minute with Insects, the soundtrack of summer, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And for this 4th of July, music from nature. Ah, the sounds of summer, crickets chirping outside your window. But which cricket is it? It doesn't sound like the eastern striped cricket. It's more like the sphagnum ground cricket. Not to be confused with the confused ground cricket. Confused yourself? Lang Elliott and Will Hirschberger can help. They've collected the songs of over 70 species of crickets, katydids, cicadas, along with gorgeous pictures and facts in a book and CD set called The Songs of Insects. We spoke to co-author Will Hirschberger when the book first came out last year. Let's listen, for instance, to one of my favorites, just the name alone, the slightly musical conehead. What is this?
It's a conehead katydid, and it's usually associated with wetlands or habitats that have lots of moisture in them.
I'm not hearing what's the katydid sound in there?
Well, the slightly musical conehead is quite different from the common true katydid, which has the katydid song. The slightly musical, all the males in a particular area will synchronize their songs with one another. So it's just this really nice, soft, pulsating chorus of these wild-looking coneheads.
So the true katydids are the only ones who make that katydid sound. As we get ready to hear that, there's a story there. Tell us the story of how they got their name.
A young lady by the name of Katie had a suitor who ran off with another woman and got married. Soon after they got back from their honeymoon, the couple was found murdered sometime during the night. Mm-hmm. They were found dead. And there was really no evidence to link Katie to the crime, though everybody suspected it was Katie. It happened in late summer while the insects were active, and to this day, they tell the tale. Katie did.
As we're speaking of katydids, I'm looking at a picture of the protean shieldback katydid. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I can see where the shield comes in. It looks like it's wearing one.
Right.
Tell us more about its sound.
Oh, the shieldbacks have a very raspy, dry, rattly sound almost, kind of a shushy timbre to their songs. They start singing at the end of day before the sun sets from the grass litter right on the ground. And as it gets dark, they climb up into the trees and brush and start singing at about eye level.
How do they make their noise?
The crickets and katydids produce their sound through a mechanism called stridulation. All of these insects have two pairs of wings. The front pair of wings are highly modified in the male to protect the true wings and to produce sound. So on the bottom side of one of those front wings is a little file of teeth. And on the top side of the other wing is a hardened ridge called a scraper. As he closes his wings, he rubs that scraper across those teeth and creates the sound. On the open stroke, he typically misses. He opens them up enough so it misses. So it's just on the closing stroke that he's making the sound. So that's stridulation.
And I understand that as we age, many of us are suffering perhaps from presbycusis.
Yes.
The decline of hearing. So we're not even hearing the insects that are out there, or a lot of them?
A lot of them. It's absolutely fascinating. When we were at Harvard giving a talk, the number of people that we would keep asking, can you hear this? Can you hear this? And a lot of people could not hear many of the insects. They're just too high-pitched.
Huh. Give us an example of a singing insect that might be hard for us to hear.
Oh, definitely. The common virtuoso katydid is one that's extremely high-pitched. And the short-winged meadow katydid is the real test of someone's hearing.
Now, we're hearing that there because you've recorded it, but we might not hear it in the wild?
Well, a lot of people can't hear the recording as well.
Really?
Yes.
Also,
yeah, if you can hear that, you're doing really good. Protected your ears really well.
Well, I don't know when that happened, but so for those who couldn't hear, it was like a... right? Is that,
yes,
is that
very
close?
Good. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I want to listen to the snowy tree cricket. Yes. I'm realizing now that some of our listeners aren't hearing anything we're talking about. But this is a singing insect that helps you tell the temperature to how.
All the males in a particular area will sing in synchrony, so it makes it really easy to count the number of chirps in 13 seconds, and then you add 40 to that number. And it gives you a really close approximation of the temperature in degrees Fahrenheit.
Hmm. Well, let's listen to a warm male snowy tree cricket. Now a cold one. Oh, that is markedly different.
Yes, it is. All these insects are cold-blooded. As they cool down, so their entire system slows down. They sing slower, the pitch lowers a little bit, but their entire nervous system is keyed into this so that as they cool down, their auditory sensitivity also gears down so that they still recognize the same species even though it's gotten really cold.
Hmm. Well, staying with, you know, temperature, cicadas, because we know the dog day cicada, that's the one that sings during the dog days of summer. But there's also the lyric cicada, the hieroglyphic cicada.
Uh-huh.
Where's that name come from?
The marvelous patterns that are on its back. If you look at that, it's kind of a turquoise background with these intricate black markings, which reminded the entomologist of hieroglyphics.
Hmm.
So that's how it got its name.
Let's listen to cicadas. I love that sound. There's something about it that signals summer and heat.
Mm-hmm.
And great literature about summer and heat and all of that. What about you and co-author Lang Elliott? Now you've put this book together, all of these different sounds. Can you sit out on a summer night without, trying to catalog everything you're listening to?
It's very difficult because you start sitting there thinking, oh, there's a fast-calling tree cricket, or oh, there goes an oblong-winged katydid. It's hard to just sit there and not identify what's going on.
And why is it important to know?
There are researchers at the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center outside of Washington, D.C., who are trying to start roadside surveys. The idea is to develop routes that are done every year. They would go through several different types of habitats. And from year to year, you count the number of singing insects that you hear. And then you develop trends over the years. Is this species declining? Is this species increasing? The other reason it's important is it gives you another aspect of appreciating nature. It is so much fun, just like going out and listening to birds and being able to say, oh, that's a northern cardinal or that's a northern parula. Now you can go out and you can say, oh, there's oblong-winged katydids, or, oh, there's a rattler round-winged katydid. You can now have this intimate knowledge of who's singing out there in the dark. Mm. There's all this talk about nature deficit disorder in the young generation. What better way to get them interested in the out-of-doors than through bugs and bugs that sing?
Was a bug, little bug, hardly there. How he felt, what he dreamed, who would care?
Will Hirschberger, he and Lang Elliott are co-authors of The Songs of Insects, a fabulous book and CD of photos, information, and sounds of dozens of types of crickets, katydids, and cicadas, a perfect excuse to play Randy Newman's The Time of Your Life from A Bug's Life.
It's the time of your life, so live it well. It's the time of your life, so live it well.